I'm Stephanie J. Block.
And I'm Mary Lee Fairbanks. And we host Stages Podcast. Binge close to 100 episodes. Hear the inside stories from backstage and behind the scenes as we go beyond the resume and into the heart of creativity and what it really takes to be in the business of show business.
Don't miss our chats with this season's Tony nominees. If you love theater and entertainment, you are going to love Stages Podcast.
Subscribe to Stages Podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts and visit us at stagespodcast.net.
Welcome to Ruthie's Table 4, a production of iHeartRadio and Atomize Studios.
In September, the River Cafe will be 36 years old. And one of the great joys of having a restaurant for so long is watching the second generation, and now even a third generation, of our early customers grow up. ADWA's parents, Charles Eboa and Camilla Lowther, have been part of the River Cafe family since we opened, and ADWA's gone from being a young child ordering pasta, butter, and cheese, and then playing in the garden space outside with her friends, to a formidable woman focused on the political and social issues relevant today. After her own struggles with mental health and to support young women's well-being, she founded the organization Girls Talk, providing a safe space for girls to access resources, share experiences, create community, and feel less alone, a place to escape the chaos of the everyday. I think a beautiful phrase. Today, ADWA's just come from the kitchen grilling scallops and frying zucchini, and she's going to tell us what she learned and read the recipe so you can cook this at home. It's both moving and exciting for me to have ADWA here.
Oh, that was so nice.
So you've been in the kitchen. Mm-hmm. You've been in the River Cafe kitchen. Which you do you remember coming here as a child?
My God, all the time.
Little girl.
All the time. With Ronnie and Jonathan.
Yeah.
They used to take us all the time.
And you've just been in the kitchen. And so you watched, your request for the recipe was scallops, grilled scallops with chili and zucchini.
My name's Adriana, and I'm a chef at the River Cafe. And today I'm cooking some scallops on the grill.
My name's Adja, and I'm not cooking anything on the grill.
You can cook it with me if you want.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, cool. We put them in the center of the grill because that's the hottest place.
How long do you have to leave them on for?
Not very long at all.
Great.
So you just keep them, don't move them around, keep them where they are, and then they'll start kind of coming off. You can kind of look at the bottom and see how they're cooking. Because if you move them too quickly, then they'll stick.
Oh, wow.
And then we're going to get some fritti made, I think. Harry, you're doing fritti, right? Can you drop some fritti for us, please?
So we have two recipes. One, I think it's really for the batter for the zucchini, and then quite simple, the scallops.
Scallops and zucchini fritti. 4 ripe zucchini, 1 liter sunflower oil. For the batter, 1 cup all-purpose flour, 3 tablespoons extra virgin olive oil. I always get really confused at the tablespoon and teaspoon.
Yeah, well, there is a difference. Like, one is quite small.
No, but like the way it's written.
Yeah, well, because it goes TBSP, that's tablespoon.
I mean,
and TSP is teaspoon.
Yeah. Okay. 3 tablespoons extra virgin olive oil, 3 tablespoons warm water, 3 egg whites. Scallops, 16 shelled sea scallops, 2 lemons, extra virgin olive oil. Cut the zucchini into ovals, then into thick matchsticks. For the batter, sift the flour into a bowl, making a well in the center. Pour in the olive oil and stir. Loosen the paste by slowly adding enough warm water to make a batter the consistency of heavy cream. Leave for 30 minutes. Heat the oil in a high-sided pan to 375 degrees. Beat the egg whites until stiff and fold into the batter. Dip zucchini, then fry in batches in hot oil until golden and crisp. Serve immediately. Scallops, heat the grill. Season the scallops very generously on both sides with salt and pepper. Actually, she said, only salt and then
only
pepper
salt.
At the end.
Don't put the pepper on.
Yeah, don't.
Okay.
It burns quickly, so put the pepper on afterwards.
Put the pepper on after.
Place on the grill until lightly brown and crisp, then turn over the grill on the other side. The scallop should be tender on the inside and crisp on the surface. Serve with lemon and a drizzle of olive oil. And I add some chili on mine.
So do you have to plate it all up?
Yes. That's the really fun part about working here, is that you get to plate all of your food.
Because who would usually do that in like another restaurant?
In other restaurants, you bring it up to the pass, and maybe someone on the pass would plate it. But here, you get to do it. And it gives you, I mean, for me, it's really satisfying.
Good portion.
That's it.
Yum. Wow. I'm coming here for dinner.
Tell me about going to Vogue with Edward, because we did, when Edward Enfield became the editor, we did the party here. Do you remember that? We had a party for him.
It was a great party.
You were the cover for his first issue.
Yeah, that was mad, that Vogue party. I remember that like it was yesterday. I remember us driving here, and Edward and I still laugh about it now. It's like, it wasn't naivety. I think it was just this, we were just doing something that felt very special to both of us. It was like this, we were embarking on this new journey, and it wasn't necessarily that we were completely naive to how the world was going to embrace it. You know, not only just people in fashion, but worldwide. It really went viral, do you know what I mean? Yeah. I think. And so as we kind of pulled up, I can't remember who I was in the car with, maybe it was like my mom and dad and sister, and we pulled up the Shepherd's Bush roundabout, and it was projected on Shepherd's Bush roundabout. What the hell is going on? And I looked on my phone, and it was just like going mad, and I actually like broke out into hives. I was like, oh my god, this is so much, I don't even know how to like deal with the situation. I pulled up to River Cafe, and Edwin and I just giggled. We could not stop laughing. I think we were both so overwhelmed by what had happened that we kind of just like could not stop laughing. It was mad. It still feels really mad.
We all had ravioli. Do you remember? We had this long discussion before whether all the Vogue people, the models and the actresses and the young beauties of today would actually have gluten, carbs, cheese, butter, and whether we would serve it. And we did. And Vogue was actually really cool because we said, do you want to find out what people want to eat? And they go, no, we're done with that. We're done with, you know, if you have a food preference, we're just going to do the menu and what they eat, they eat. And everybody had ravioli, and everybody, a lot of people had seconds of ravioli. And yet the whole issue of being a model about your body, talk about being a woman in a profession that requires you to be a certain shape and size.
I think I don't remember being worried. I think there were moments when I was at school where I was kind of worried about what I looked like. Sometimes I wasn't at a girls' school, but, you know, I lived in a house full of women, so sometimes when someone would get a bit like weird with food or they'd have, you know, issues, it kind of sometimes bleeds into everyone else within the community. Do you know what I mean? We see that all the time. And I think when I started modeling, I don't again remember feeling that pressured about it. I think I just felt like incredibly painful in my own body in general, so it wasn't necessarily like kind of weight related. I think there's always been like parts of my body that I haven't like loved, you know what I mean, and I've had to grow to love.
Are you the kind of person that can eat but not gain weight?
Because I've always done lots and lots of sports.
But were other models that you were with, what did you feel that to be a model you had to be a sport?
Yeah, I got weird with food for a period of time, where actually when I got sober, and they call that transference, you know, I think I was just trying to control something else in my life. So I got a bit weird with food when I was about 22. I think it was just control, to be quite honest. And I think weight for me, you know, I suffer with anxiety, you know, and so when I'm anxious, it just falls off.
It falls off,
yeah. I'm not the type of person. Sometimes I am eating, but it literally just falls off all the time. So sometimes I haven't even been like aware of like dropping weight. I think I've always done a lot of exercise and I kind of now do Pilates. So I build a lot of muscle. So my body has changed, like, you know, over the course of like many years, I think. And so I think, I think when I got started modeling properly, I decided there was a part of me that had that to do it, to really kind of walk into it again, I had to take on, it was almost like a, it wasn't necessarily that I felt like that, but I had to be like, this is who I am, do you know what I mean? Like, take it or leave it, do you know what I mean? I'm not going to be sucked into this idea that I should be thinner or look a different sort of way for you to kind of appreciate me or want me. So I had to, and that's not exactly how I felt all the time, but I had to sort of fake it to make it. So it wasn't necessarily, I think I've always, I don't know, I was speaking on the pod, my own podcast about this the other day. I think, I wonder if my relationship with myself will ever be what I want it to be whilst I model.
Interesting.
I don't know if my, I have a, to a certain extent, a healthy relationship with myself, but I wonder if my relationship with my body will ever be what I want it to be as long as I'm kind of within the industry. And yes, it has changed like drastically. Do you know what I mean? The likes of amazing people spearheading different sorts of movements. But, you know, we only have to kind of look at certain photos or fashion shows and we see the kind of the pressure that's put on us. When
I almost find it painful. I haven't been to that many catwalk shows. I think, and probably it has changed. When you see, you know, how thin and kind of serious and, you know, I know it's there to just showcase the clothes, and so it's like being a hanger. But there is something as a woman to see women doing that job is a little bit
And also when you know that someone's, like, kind of unwell, whatever that looks like for different people, when you know someone's kind of suffering with, and, you know, disordered eating, but they are praised and celebrated within the industry and they work even more. It's that in itself is an uncomfortable thing to get your head around. I think that's where sometimes the pressure for me lies. It isn't that I want to be unwell, it's just the fact that I see people doing well because of it. Do you know what I mean? And it, that's a mad thing to get your head around. Do you know what I mean? And it's, and I don't think that kind of breeds healthy ways of looking at yourself. You know, if you're being told that you are better for being thin.
And I suppose the other, you know, what we haven't talked about, we've talked about body image and modeling, but we haven't talked about race. And I think that there is also the issue of what it was like to be, or what it is like to be, a woman of color in a very, what was, which, thanks to Edward, it's not so much, and people like Edward. But how that affected your...
I think that's something that I'm really delving into at the moment, is how a lack of understanding about my own identity has really kind of hindered certain aspects of my growth, do you know what I mean? And having been brought up in a predominantly white space, what that, how that has affected me, how the things that I've tolerated, the things that I've kind of brushed off. And I think because of the resurgence of Black Lives Matter, the conversations that they were having, it kind of, it really kind of shook people's core. It wasn't that we were just talking about slavery, something that happened, you know, years and years ago when
Not that many years ago.
I know, but for certain people, like, they weren't around where they happened, you know, when that happened. So they were like, oh, well, I wasn't part of that. Do you know what I mean? I didn't do anything like that. And I think Black Lives Matter kind of brought it, made it current. And suddenly you were kind of, they were speaking about things that you had to check yourself on. And I had to, suddenly was, I think, validated in a lot of experiences and feelings that I had surrounding my own race, and how I'd had to kind of navigate certain situations. And also, I think I was also, my privilege, you know, we talk about colorism within the community as being someone who's like mixed race and lighter skinned, the way that I was treated compared to... my cousins who are, you know, who are a lot darker skinned than me. You know, I think that's a conversation that we don't have enough either. But for me, I think it was great, you know, when Edward started doing what he was doing, what he does and continues to do, and sets the bar so high continuously. I think for me, it had always been unspoken how uncomfortable I'd felt in certain situations. Mm. It was almost that I didn't want to give it a name. It's like I felt that there were certain reasons why my career hadn't taken off, you know. When I'd started with certain people, you know, who looked very different to me, I think I still was searching for something that was completely unattainable, different hair, different body shape, you know, sometimes even like, you know, different coloured skin, you know. And so I think I didn't want to blame it on something like that. I was like, why? You know, I started at the same time as Cara. I started at the same time as so many girls, and they kind of reached such great heights. And I was like, why is that? Do you know what I mean? And I think it was quite nice when Edward, there was many things that were beautiful about it, but like having him come in and be like, we got to change that. This is what is going on. Do you know what I mean?
Were you born here or in Ghana?
Yeah, yeah, born in London.
And your father is
Ghanaian. He was born in Accra.
So going back was part of your childhood?
Yeah, very much so. It was always something that we did. Sometimes my mum came and sometimes it was just the three of us. And I think it felt quite alien at that time. And as I grew older and kind of my career changed and obviously I became like a grown-up, my relationship with Ghana very much changed. I felt like kind of, instead of just a kind of traveller, someone who'd like been born in London and who'd come back to Ghana, I felt like they really claimed me, which was really like a kind of beautiful experience, you know. I think especially after the British Vogue cover, you know, it was like, they call you a Bruni, which means like a kind of traveller, because I'm obviously a little like paler skin than most Ghanaians. And I think after that, I felt very much like kind of claimed by the people there, which was really, really amazing. But I have the most amazing memories of Ghana. We always used to stay at my grandma and granddad's. It's just a modest house next to a nursery. So there were always like kids playing outside. My grandma has always had a little kind of like corner shop. So we'd go in there, get our like cold bottles of like Coke and like biscuits. Then we'd sit there and watch her and my Aunt Mary. All three of them lived together. So we'd watch them
thing. Did you cook? Did she cook for you?
Yeah, she cooked. And then she had a woman who also helped her comfort.
What is Ghanaian food like?
It's amazing. I mean, you've got the jollof rice, you've got lots of different kind of fish, you've got fufu.
What's fufu?
So it's like a kind of dough that you dip into a soup. The spice there is kind of like, it's like an oily one. It's amazing.
And chili?
Yeah.
A lot of chili?
Yeah.
And fish?
Really spicy. Yeah.
Do you go to the market?
The markets are mad.
Are they?
Mad. Like, insane. Just, like, bustling. Food, clothes, people wandering around. It's, like, mental. But amazing.
And how long would you stay?
We'd stay for, like, 2 weeks.
Yeah.
I have some cousins who usually stay there a bit longer. Dad and my sister were there this year. My dad goes back all the time.
He does.
All the time. Yeah. My granddad's not alive anymore. My Aunt Mary, she's not alive anymore. But my grandma, very much still there. And my Aunt Tina lives with her. So,
And so what was it like growing up in your house? You have memories of meals, you know, who cooked. And
House has always been a place that is kind of, people are in and out at all times. You know, I very much grew up with, maybe it was someone who had to move in for a bit. You know, my godfather would move in, or someone in, you know, distress would be upstairs, living in the upstairs room. There were always parties and dinner parties and lots of different people kind of in and out of the house. You know, my mum has always been like an entertainer. My dad as well. The home has always been one that kind of, it feels like sacred, but they're not precious about it. You know?
Yeah, a place that people want to
come to. Yeah, the carpets are rolled up when a party happens. Nice. But, you know, they've never been kind of like prim and proper, their places. But
and were you kids part of it? You weren't sitting on the steps watching the party go on. You were down there.
No, we'd be down there. We do like things like coat check.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nice. And be like, charge everyone money. And then they'd find all their coats just piled up on one bed, pretending like we'd organize them. Or we'd be like sat on the staircase watching everyone get up to whatever mischief they were getting up to. And then later on, we were just joining in.
Would you go out a lot? Would you go out to restaurants?
We do such amazing things, you know.
What did you do?
That's the thing about growing up in London. It's like, I mean, I wouldn't want to bring my children up anywhere else. I loved it. Galleries and restaurants, and they took us everywhere.
Did they?
It was never about separation. It was like, you want to sit with the grown-ups? You learn how to sit with the grown-ups. Mm-hmm. You learn how to converse and listen and talk to whoever might be next to you or in front of you. But it was never like, my parents were never into the idea of like putting you on the kids' table.
Yeah.
You know, if we were younger, it was like, come out, enjoy yourself. When you get tired, just sleep under the table.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And then we'll go home.
And then you went away to boarding school?
Yeah.
Yeah, what was that like?
The food.
Yeah.
Horrible.
Horrible. And Millfield's meant, was it Millfield?
Yeah.
It's meant to be rather proud of it, but was it?
I mean,
terrible.
Do you know what? Maybe this is my snobby side. Not great with a buffet. I think school kind of like traumatized me from that. I mean, some days it would be good. Like the salad station was like banging. Like that was good. But to be quite honest, I lived off Domino's for like 5 years.
Oh, you were allowed to?
You weren't. We weren't allowed, but we'd like sneak it in. And then in prep, we'd like run out and get the pizza and like bring it back in and all share it. On Fridays, we were allowed like to order an Indian or a Chinese.
Interesting. So that must have been quite shocking to go from a house that was full of people and friends and good food.
I think it was also, I mean, there were certain days where it was good. Yeah. Chinese day wasn't that bad. Indian day wasn't that bad.
How old were you?
13 to 18.
That's 5 years. And then you'd come back weekends, or would you stay?
Well, you were only allowed, what do they call it? I can't remember what they used to call. Exeat.
Exeat, yeah.
You were only allowed a certain amount of exeats, but I had the best house mistress on the face of the planet, Mrs. Orton. And she, I was really homesick.
Yeah.
I mean, I kind of got over it, but it wasn't my favourite of years being at that school. I had some great friends, but I was just desperate to come back to London.
Then from Millfield, you went to university. You went to, what was that like?
Brunel, yeah.
Where is Brunel?
That's in Uxbridge. I mean, I tried to get into Goldsmiths. I failed my English exam. I can't remember which one it was, because you realise that it really doesn't matter.
No, it doesn't.
I'm just telling you. I mean, try your best, do all the things, but like,
so for the listener, we're here with a friend of mine's daughter and the head executive chef's daughter, Pearl Helena. Pearl joined us today because she's a 15-year-old aspiring actor. She's an enormous admirer of your work. And so
I can't believe Pearl's 15, though.
There you go. We were talking about whether university matters. So what was that like?
Obviously wanted to save money, so lived at home.
But were you happy there?
I had the best time.
Why?
Because I think it was just, I was back home. I was back in London. I was back. It was predominantly, I mean, Millfield was very kind of like intersectional, do you know what I mean, in many ways, but it was predominantly white. And I think coming back to London, it wasn't just the kind of necessarily race, it was also a boiling pot of people who'd grown up differently. Do you know what I mean? It was like I'd grown up completely different to a lot of the people in my kind of class, but I felt like that was just more me. I just wanted to be amongst that.
So living at home, did it come back? Did it feel like before you went to Mill, were you back to being a child again?
No, it was very weird. It was very weird. I wouldn't say it was a great time for mine and my parents' relationship. I think, you know, I think they thought sending me to boarding school, there would be more rules. Mm. But actually, when someone doesn't know you, like a teacher, you can get around them, do you know what I mean? Like, actually, you've kind of weirdly got more space to roam. Yeah. And so coming back to London, obviously there were certain rules, but I think if I was honest, and I've spoken to them about this anyway, I think coming back home after 5 years, I was a bit like, you can't really tell me what to do. Do you know what I mean? We haven't lived together for 5 years. So I think that dynamic was quite hard on our relationship. I think I probably regressed. I think I wasn't used to the fact that I was back living under their roof. And I was like very much a different person.
Yeah. I remember once saying to my father, I might have said this once before, saying to my father when I was 30 or 28 or whatever, and I'd been living in London and working, and my parents lived in upstate New York in Woodstock. And I once went home and I was said to my dad, oh, I'm going to leave the baby and go into New York tomorrow. And he said, I don't think you should do that. And I said, you know what? I live in London and I work and I don't have to ask anybody's, nice way I said permission. But it's interesting that when, I go home, I don't know whether I'm a child or I'm an adult.
Yeah.
And he said, I'll make it really easy for you, Ruthie. The minute you walk in that door, you're a child.
Really?
And it was actually quite nice because I thought that's kind of why I like going home, is that suddenly somebody's saying, no, why don't you stay here or whatever. It was just interesting.
It's like a dance, isn't it? You have to learn how to live with each other again.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Help helps is a maxim I believe in. We all carry around stress and hardship, and when we keep it inside, it starts to chip away. Therapy is a safe place, and therapy is for everyone. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Visit BetterHelp.com/Ruthie today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Ruthie. BetterHelp.com/Ruthie.
We started talking about this incident. Drugs and officials cover up. You couldn't believe it.
From iHeart Podcasts.
It's like the police knew who he was before they got here.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
He's breathing right now?
Yes, he's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
There's no way that guy's a doctor.
I'm Paul Pringle, and I'm an investigative reporter for the LA Times. This is the story of an investigation that starts in a hotel room in Pasadena, California, and reaches all the way to the top of two of the most powerful institutions in the city of Los Angeles.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, everyone knew.
This is Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption.
We're always going to have predators. It's the good people who stand by and do nothing that allow them to flourish.
Listen to Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
When you went to Brunel, what were you thinking of majoring in? What was your
theater?
Idea?
Yeah, theater. That's what I finished. That's yeah. What I majored in.
Yeah. Did you eat out a lot? Did you party? Did you?
Yeah, I went out all the time.
Did you? And
all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, we were so.
What
funny.
Year was this?
I was 18.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you were born in
1992.
Yeah. 1992.
So what did I finish school? 2010. Yeah. So
yeah.
11. Yeah.
Yeah.
We had the best time. I worked as soon as I kind of finished school.
Modeling?
There were bits of modeling, but it wasn't, there was like a different time, do you know what I mean? So I worked in the shop, I worked as a nanny. But we had so much fun, do you know what I mean? It was like, I don't know how it is for you, Pearl, but we were so carefree and mad and doing our thing. And
well, you were probably 18. Then.
Yeah, and we all pile our money. Yeah, I just mean being young, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, we weren't bothered about kind of what clothes we were wearing or anything like that. We didn't have the pressure of like social media or anything like that. It was just about being in a gang, do you know what I mean? And roaming the streets. And
mostly girls, or was it?
Yeah, mostly. I've always been a girl's girl.
Yeah.
And we'd all put our money together and, like, share one meal, like, poor restaurants where we'd just sit for hours and hours and hours outside kind of coffee shops sharing one coffee between, like, five of us. And they're like, can you leave if you're not going to buy anything? Can you leave? Yeah. Or we'd go to, like, kind of... My friend Josh DeLissa, who might as well be my brother, he had a restaurant called Boom Burger. We'd go in there, get cheap prices. We had some Mexican restaurants around the area, and we'd all put our money together to share, like, kind of one plate of food. Because, I mean, we were quite naughty. We were spending our money on, like, alcohol and going out. So we didn't really have a massive interest in spending our money on food.
So modelling, when did that happen? How did that happen?
I mean, I've been modelling on and off since I was probably, since I left school. So since I was 18. Now, I did a few bits and pieces, like, before, but my mum was very strict about, and my dad as well, about finishing school. Mm. Modelling kind of took quite a long time to kind of take off, so that's why I kind of worked.
Did you enjoy it?
Yeah,
did
I did.
Like the process?
I think I've learned to like it more. I learned to like it when I, as cheesy as this sounds, when I started to like myself, to be quite honest. Mm. Do you know what I mean? That's when it became more fun. And yes, there are days when I'm on my period or I'm a bit exhausted where I'm like, this is literally the last thing I want to do. Do you know what I mean? It's be like kind of showcased in front of a bunch of people and then kind of... It's like Instagram have to kind of... And then I start picking apart my kind of who I am. Do you know what I mean? Face value, not who I am as a person, actually. But
can I ask a question?
Yeah.
What made you want to do a podcast?
I think it goes back to this idea of storytelling, I think. And the information out there on what lived experience does in regards to stigma reduction and suicide reduction. And so I couldn't think of a better place. There's something about an honest conversation, an honest chat.
Intimate, isn't it?
Yeah, there's so much like intimacy within that, and to just listen to someone. And I think it really was that. It's like to talk to someone, to hear their side of a story, to hear where they've come from and where they're at and where they hope to be. I think that's definitely the essence of having the podcast, is that idea that when we hear someone else's story, we're going to feel less alone. Yeah.
So you were talking about Girls Talk. Tell me when the next series that you're so excited about is coming out.
So podcast, I'd say just keep a lookout. It'll be towards the end of the year. Keep a lookout for September.
How do we look for it?
Yeah, so just our Instagram handle is Girls Talk. I'm at Girls Talk, G-U-R-L-S, Talk.
Do you listen to Girls Talk?
Yeah, I have.
What do you like about it?
I love listening to things that say, like, you know, I love listening to things that's just like, yeah, that so should be said, that so should be spoken about more, you know what I mean? People's fear of speaking out stops them from saying the truth, you know? That's what I really like about it, you know? Like, speaking about grievances or trauma or, like, mental health, like all those type of things are just not talked about enough. Yeah.
And I think I can't wait for the new season to come out. I feel more grown up and even more opinionated and even more confident. Mm. I find, and I don't know if this is because of social media or cancel culture, that sometimes we're quite agreeable with each other, and I want to have conversations that aren't always with people that I agree with. Yeah. I want to also learn about things that I have no idea about, and I want to sometimes have those uncomfortable conversations where I'm not only kind of not necessarily agreeing with the other person, but I'm also being checked about what I don't know and the ways that I think about things, do you know what I mean? And so we've kind of changed that, and it's going to be really cool. We've got some mega people on the podcast. Yeah. I love hearing people's stories, you know. I love meeting people, you know, who
That's
come
why I like
from different
a
backgrounds. Exactly.
Everybody comes in with a story. You look around, I've had people come in and say, oh, you know, look at how this fabulous restaurant, and I've had such a hard time lately. And I went to every table, everybody would have a story.
You're so good at that, though, how you walk
about,
around.
Yeah, but, you know, people, you know, we all think that you see all these people and their lives are perfect, and then you find out one is a kid, you know, they've just been divorced, or they've had a kid with addiction, or they have, everybody has a story. Mm-hmm. And so those smiling, happy faces, whether you see them on Instagram or here, you know that everybody has a story. And as you say, I love walking around and just hearing a bit of the story or saying hello. Do you think, Pearl, that when Edward talked about social media pressure, do you think that exists now a lot?
Well, I think especially hearing about what you were saying about how when you were a kid and you used to, like, it used to be much different to it is now because you didn't have social media. And I think it really affects more how people look at themselves because you've got Instagram and you've got TikTok and you've got all these things. And if you don't have it, you're, like, not in with the times. But if you do, then you're just making yourself feel worse by yourself. But you can't be, like... like, for example, when people are like, oh, I don't want social media, it's bad. People look down on you for it. But in reality, it's much better if you didn't have it. Like, for you, you're probably happier in those times than, like, kids are now.
Oh, 100%, because there's one thing, you know, getting to know yourself and figuring out who you are over those, like, 13 to 18 and then onwards. Do you know what I mean? It was, like, such a confusing time. Yeah. And that's already, like... You know, I was talking to these girls the other day, like 13 to 14, and there was a question like, what would you say to your younger self? And I would be like, I used to scrutinize every single thing I did, the shoes I wore, the way I wore my eyeliner, the way my hair was, the way I carried my bag, the way I walked. Do you know what I mean? I was like always on my case about every single movement. And I think I would tell everyone that you don't need to do that. I wish I'd stop putting so much pressure on myself, because you realise when your world gets bigger that none of it truly matters, do you know what I mean? And I think to add in the pressure of having to kind of be perceived by other people, it's like I already was kind of self-conscious, so to then have to kind of portray a person that I maybe hadn't become yet, do you know what I mean? Something that was maybe just kind of performative would have been like an added pressure at that time.
And you know, it happens at any age. You know, I can, you know, we're talking women's talk. My husband died a year and a half ago. And sometimes I just look on Instagram and go, you know, another happy family, you know, and their, you know, beach resort, or another grandparents with their grandchildren. I mean, I have that life, but you know, it's very, you can look at it in terms of whether you're thin enough, whether you're, you know, whether your hair is as beautiful, whether you're a certain type, what the clothes you're wearing, the way you carry a handbag, or you can look at it in families and you can see, you know, it just feels that there's, I never post from a vacation. I learned that a long time ago. There's nothing worse than on a day like today working and then you see somebody on there, you know.
That's what I'm just saying.
It's like,
I was saying that yesterday.
Started talking about this incident, drugs and officials cover up. You couldn't believe it.
From iHeart Podcasts.
It's like the police knew who he was before they got here.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
He's breathing right now? Yes, he's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
There's no way that guy's a doctor.
I'm Paul Pringle, and I'm an investigative reporter for the LA Times. This is the story of an investigation that starts in a hotel room in Pasadena, California, and reaches all the way to the top of two of the most powerful institutions in the city of Los Angeles.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, oh, everyone knew.
This is Fallen Angels, the story of California corruption.
We're always going to have predators. It's the good people who stand by and do nothing that allow them to flourish.
Listen to Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, my name's Jay Shetty, and I'm the host of On Purpose. I just had a great conversation with Michael B. Jordan, and you can listen to it right now. Michael is known for his performances in both film and television. His breakout role was in Fruitvale Station, playing Oscar Grant, which earned him widespread praise and numerous award nominations. His portrayal of Killmonger in Marvel's Black Panther, one of my favorites, further solidified his status as one of Hollywood's leading actors, earning him widespread acclaim for his complex and compelling performance. In our conversation, Michael really opens up. You're going to love listening to it, and I can't wait for you to check it out.
The closest to getting what you want is always the hardest. It's always the feeling when you're getting ready to, you know, people give up right before they get what they've always wanted to get. People quit.
Listen to On Purpose with Jay Shetty on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Is that acting what you wanted to do when you went to Brunel?
Yeah, that's what, from 13 until 18, I did that at school. And then I went on to study that at Brunel. And then kind of life took a different direction, not only kind of personally, and then it became something, you know, then I kind of fell into modeling and that started taking over. So I kind of jumped on that bandwagon and that led me to where I am now. And then I think just before COVID, I made a kind of decision that I wanted to give it another go. Mm. You know, I wanted to put 100% in it and see where it would take me. Because I think when I first left university, I had a different head on my shoulders and my priorities were warped and I wasn't a very happy person. So I didn't, you know, have the capability or to give it 100%. So that's where I'm at now. I'm on that journey.
Good.
And I absolutely love it. It's good. Ridiculously hard. Respect to all
actors and actresses. Is it film or actresses. Is it theatre that you want to do?
Oh, I would love to do theatre one day, but at the moment it's TV and film.
TV and film. And now you're living in your own apartment?
My own house. Yeah.
How is that?
Oh, it's really nice.
Well, what's your kitchen? So you do have an open kitchen there as well?
Yeah.
What's it like?
Kitchen, it's, my kitchen's yellow, blue and white tiles.
Yeah.
I mean.
Describe it.
It's very much open. I've got an island in the middle that has like a kind of heart boner engraved in it that my friend Jeff did.
Yes.
It's got a massive, big, like kind of teak table with matching chairs that I upholstered in like leopard print.
Are you like your parents? Do you like people coming to you instead of you going to them?
Yeah, I love it. I mean, I think to a certain extent, I grew up in an African household. So the idea that we were going to spend the night at other people's houses was like something that was like, my dad just did not understand. He's like, you have a bed, you have a house. Like, why do you need to go and stay at someone else's house? Yeah. There were certain people that we went to, but like eating at home and sleeping at home has always been like a kind of a priority within our house. You know,
and
let's be together.
What do you cook now when you have your kitchen? Or do you go out most of the
time? I was talking to Pearl about it, actually. I mean, I actually eat in a lot. I now spend a lot of time between London and LA. And when I was working before COVID, I didn't really have the time to cook. It wasn't necessarily a priority of mine. So I used to order a lot of takeaway. And I think after COVID, I started reprioritizing what was important. So I did have more time. And so my boyfriend's a really good cook. My sister lives with me and she's an amazing cook. I like cooking if it's like family or people who are really close to me. I don't feel the pressure. I'm not, the idea of cooking for like 10 people is something that doesn't excite me. If I'm cooking for myself, it's like simple things like fish and vegetables or eggs, soup, you know, stuff like that.
You don't eat meat?
No, I don't eat meat. I eat fish.
Has that been recently or is it?
No, I haven't eaten. Do you know what? Weirdly, I've started like, I think I've just been listening to my body a bit more.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, if it's the time of the month or something like that, I'm like, oh, I kind of really feel like some meat.
Mm-hmm.
And I've never had that before. So I kind of am listening to my body a bit more. But I still very much, like, kind of in, when I'm cooking at home, especially in LA, we have, like, a tiny, tiny kitchen. So we're not going to cook fish because it would just make the whole house smell like fish, the little flat we have. So we cook a lot of vegetarian stuff in LA. And then at home, you know, I have more space. And so we cook lots of different things and have people round. I wish I've grown up in a household full of amazing cooks. My cousin's an amazing cook, my aunt and my uncle, everyone. You know, they have recipes that were handwritten by my grandma about certain things.
I love
those.
I mean?
That. And I think, I remember my mom always
is
saying that when
Ghanaian grandmother, your mother's
mom's mom, I always remember my mom, like, I mean, there are many things that were kind of sad when her mum died, but I think she always thinks about, you know, when she needs answers on certain recipes, yeah. She always thinks about the idea of calling my grandma. And my dad is an amazing cook as well. Huh. And so I should be more interested in it.
Well, you don't, there's no
I'm
such
the
word
cleaner.
As should. You
I'm
could,
the cleaner.
Yeah, well, that's fine. You know, I think everybody figures out.
I do the dishes.
Well, that's fine.
Yeah, food,
do you remember when it became possible for you to go out to eat and not think about how much it cost?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think, so I moved, 2017, I moved to LA when I got sober. But I wasn't eating out that much, to be quite honest. I didn't have the money. I'd kind of taken a year off, and my mum and dad were supporting me for the first time in a long time, which I found like kind of incredibly uncomfortable. So I kind of was under a certain budget, do you know what I mean? And I think probably maybe when I really could just like go to the restaurants and come here and like pay for myself, I probably was about 25.
And
yeah,
you'd been,
25
and the
on.
Income had come from modelling or to acting? Or both?
Yeah, modelling.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
That was a big change.
Yeah, moving to New York.
Yeah.
So I moved to New York when I was 24.
Right.
Had my 25th birthday in New York. And that's probably when it started to change. You know, that's when I could like order a takeaway or like go to this restaurant called Lucienne and like, or get my friend a meal or pay.
You're
you know,
not alone in that, you know, that it was something that I was talked when I talked to David Beckham. He said he remembered when he took Victoria out and they could actually, you know, not have to completely look at the prices on the right-hand side. Or Paul McCartney saying that he thought wine was a horrible drink because he could only afford the cheapest wine, which, as we know, is pretty hard
well,
to
do you
drink.
Know what?
And
the
he
weird
just thought wine
is-
was a horrible drink until he went out with Brian, you know, Epstein, who was his manager, and they ordered a fantastic bottle of Lafitte and thought, oh, that's what wine is.
Well, so the mad thing is I've never tried a good glass of wine.
Well,
never.
Well, you're sober now.
Yeah,
so.
No, but I got
but
sober when
that,
I was 20.
Cheap wine.
I got sober when I was 22,
yeah.
So I wasn't, like, spending the money
right,
on, like,
right.
We were going to the corner shop and
yeah.
getting, like, a Casarillo Diablo.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? And, like, a cheap
yeah.
bottle of tequila with a
yeah.
hat on it.
Yeah, yeah.
So bad, rank, so rank. And sure. So I've never actually, you know, I've never had a, like, stunning cocktail.
Yeah.
I've never had a, like, beautiful glass of wine, and it's fine. But it is mad to think that I've never actually, because, and to be honest, like, that's why I could probably, like, go and eat out. Do you know what I mean? I've never had the expense of having to kind of buy alcohol.
Yeah, alcohol as well. And I suppose, you know, for me that is, you know, we all have reasons why we eat the food we eat. Food can be something you have when you're hungry. It can be something that you have when you want to cook or you want to entertain. It can be, food can be alleviation of pain or sadness. So I suppose, Edouard, that my last question to you is, what would you turn to if you needed food for comfort?
I'd go home, definitely. I don't know if it's anything in particular. I think it would just be something cooked by my mum and dad.
That's
anything
nice.
That was put in front of me
yeah.
would feel comforting.
That's beautiful, and a beautiful way to end a wonderful
thank
talk and a
so
wonderful
much.
Afternoon. Thank you. Oh, love you.
Love you.
Good.
Love you, Pearl.
Yeah, we love you, Pearl. Thanks.
Thank you.
The River Cafe Lookbook is now available in bookshops and online. It has over 100 recipes beautifully illustrated with photographs from the renowned photographer Matthew Donaldson. The book has 50 delicious and easy-to-prepare recipes, including a host of River Cafe classics that have been specially adapted for new cooks. The River Cafe Lookbook, recipes for cooks of all ages. Ruthie's Table 4 is a production of iHeartRadio and Atomize Studios. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's a simple truth. No matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp.
provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's Better, H-E-L-P.com.
I'm Stephanie J. Block.
And I'm Mary Lee Fairbanks.
And we host Stages Podcast. Binge close to 100 episodes. Hear the inside stories from backstage and behind the scenes as we go beyond the resume and into the heart of creativity and what it really takes to be in the business of show business.
Don't miss our chats with this season's Tony nominees. If you love theater and entertainment, you are going to love Stages Podcast.
Subscribe to Stages Podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts and visit us at stagespodcast.net.